Hello, collective pop hive mind. Welcome back to Big Mouth, where we feel the bumps on pop culture's skull in search of interesting deviant tendencies. I'm Andrew Harrison, and I'm joined as usual by Sean Pattenden, the upright and admirable Elizabeth Gareth Anderson, to my discredited Andrew Wakefield. Hello, Sean. How are you doing?
I'm all right, thank you.
So I see you got invited to an intimate special show at the 100 Club, and I didn't. What's going on there?
Friends in High Places.
Yeah.
I asked for a ticket, Andrew. You could have asked for a ticket. I actively went and said, can I come to this thing? I'd be really excited if I went.
Well, if I'd known it was on, I would have asked, but nobody told me that it was on. How was it as a soiree? Were there many exciting two-tone celebrity sightings?
I couldn't spot anyone. And Rhoda Dacar was there, but I didn't spot her. There were all sorts of people there, but it was amazing.
You didn't get stuck really behind Phil Jupitus, is the usual state of affairs on these things.
I was near Sean Cavini.
Oh, right, yeah. That's nice.
And Smiley was there, friend of the show.
Friend of the show, Michael Smiley.
Yeah, and Miranda Sawyer. So that was, it was good fun.
So everybody but me.
Talked about you as well.
Thanks for that. In our continuing coverage of the Fire Festival, by the way, did you notice that Evian guy Andy is now getting his own TV show?
Hooray. Hooray, that's amazing news.
It's the quote was, let's just say it's going to be a show about hosting crazy events, what it takes to make them happen. There'll be cliffhangers and you'll get to follow me around and see how I pull them off. Yeah, beyond to the amazing. We should offer him a podcast, shouldn't we? Before we meet our guest, by the way, I have a correction to make from last week's show. As listener Mike Albert pointed out, Rizzle Kicks did Mamma Do the Hump, not Rudimental, as I so crassly said. So give me a break. I'm old and the new groups confuse me. Our first guest is Will Hodgkinson, the Times rock and pop critic and author of a series of books, including Guitar Man, where he learns to play guitar, and The House is Full of Yogis, where he details his upbringing amongst actual hippies in actual cults and things like that. He is also a time traveller, as friend of the show Alexis Petridis discovered this week. He found a picture of Elton John in the early 1970s, apparently talking to present-day Will. It was actually Al Cooper, and that gives you an idea of how stylishly Will dresses. Hello, Will.
Welcome. Hello. Thank you very much for the Al Cooper connection.
It's uncanny. It's you. It's obviously you.
You know when people say, this guy looks like you, and you think, that's so crass because he looks absolutely nothing like me. I saw that picture, I thought, that is me. That's really weird. What am I doing there?
Have you been, like, going for the Al Cooper in your life, maybe even
subconsciously? No, I didn't really know much about Al Cooper. I knew that he played in Dylan's early band. I knew that he was in Blood, Sweat and Tears, but that was it. I didn't really know that much about him. But the problem is, I quite liked Al Cooper's look, but he's also alive now, and so I've seen a picture of what I look like at age 76.
Yeah.
And it's not pretty. It's kind of exactly what I'd expect from myself, which is clinging on to youth pathetically. So,
it's the only way to cling on to it.
I knew that I was going to end up like that. I know that at the age of 76, I'll be wandering around wearing dark glasses and bumping into things. And that is essentially what Al Cooper's doing.
Speaking of wearing dark glasses and bumping into things, you were also at the special show.
I was.
Somebody else was at the special show. Did you have a good time, Will? That show I wasn't at?
I loved it. I tell you what was nice, and I'm sure Sean will agree with me. It was, I thought it was all going to be old gits. Present company included, but it was actually a real mix, and there were loads of young kids there, and that was great. And they were going crazy. And I thought, after the show, I was thinking, wow, people know this. And I asked my kids, who are teenagers, so do you know the specials? Going, yeah, they're pretty famous. Mm. And I thought that the specials were sort of a time, and those songs weren't particularly remembered. But it turns out everyone knows Ghost Town. A lot of people know Too Much Too Young, and quite a few people know Gangsters and Monkey Business and all the other ones. And so it was nice to see that this band, who are now approaching 60, have still got something which carries them through to the modern age. And so it was a really, really good gig.
Oh, great. A really good gig.
Yeah, it was excellent. Yeah.
Where were you, Andrew?
Really good.
I was sitting at home writing scripts for this show. What pop things are you most excited about this year?
This is a kind of big one, but I'm really excited about seeing Neil Young and Bob Dylan share a stage and argue about who's going to headline. And I've interviewed Neil Young before. I've never interviewed Dylan. But he's one of the most difficult men imaginable. I sort of love him for that. And, it was in the papers recently that the whole thing is Hyde Park is as commercial as it gets. You get paid an absolute fortune for those gigs. He would have known that it was sponsored by Barclaycard. There's no question. But once all the papers signed and the announcement was made, he did this big statement saying, I would never play a concert where Barclaycard is sponsoring it. I want all the banners taken down, which is classic Neil Young. It's playing his cards when he can, and controlling it. And I saw him Do you remember that gig called Old Cella in California, which Neil Young and Bob Dylan,
McCartney.
Yeah, yes.
Roger Waters.
Exactly. Yeah, they're all there, the Stones. And Neil Young refused. So they had this £1 million screen, and you know it's kind of amazing. Wherever you're standing or sitting, you could see the whole thing.
Yeah.
Neil Young refused to have the screens, to the extent that he covered the entire thing with vast burlap sack, you know, which is just so typical of Neil Young. So the idea of seeing him and Bob Dylan together, you know, the two very ornery old men, it's going
to
be interesting.
Two things about that. I think Dylan will go on first because he likes to go to bed early. And like Dylan will be on and off by 9:30 most of his gigs. And the other thing, maybe is Neil Young still worried about big screens after the last waltz and the editing that had to be done to take out an illegal bat in the cave. That was very visible.
It's going back a bit, but it's a theory. Yeah.
Good heavens.
Speaking of the specials, they went on at 6, didn't they, Will, at our special gig that
went to.
They went on really early. It was great.
We went home by 7.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now, you just heard him there. It's Big Mouth regular Eamon Ford. He writes for Q, The Big Issue, as well as loads of music business publications. And he's back in the world because after an extended elephant's pregnancy, as we don't call it, his book, The Final Days of EMI, Selling the Pig, is out on February the 21st and available to order now from all good booksellers, listeners. Hello, Eamon. How are you?
I am very well. Good to be back.
Fabulous. Lovely to see you.
Thank you.
We're going to talk about your book in detail later.
Oh, no, I'm sorry about that.
We are. But why Selling the Pig?
Selling the Pig is, the very quick story is that it was Citibank who were actually trying to sell EMI for years. Some bankers within that had a very negative view of EMI. They used to refer to it as a cancer patient going through chemotherapy. And when the Terra Firma deal went through, one banker emailed another and went, "Congratulations, I see you finally sold the pig."
Nothing to do with Pink Floyd.
No, certainly not.
As well as pop music, you're the Coronation Street correspondent around here.
I am, yes.
What's the deal with Maureen Lipman? How's she getting on? You mentioned her when you were on before.
Best new character in years.
Right. Yeah.
Genuinely brilliant. Yeah. And there's the backstory is slowly kind of evolving. So she kind of commits. She was a very kind of acidic tongued character, very in the tradition of the great Blanche Hunt. Mm. But there's a lot more kind of pathos coming through, and she's just an astonishing actor as well. She's just amazing in every scene. But it's Coronation Street at its absolute best, like really poignant, camp, acidic.
Is she going to turn out to be a murderer?
No, but she has a family connection to Tyrone, who's like one of the main characters. But their backstory is kind of slowly being unfurled.
Is Tyrone still around? I haven't seen
So he is, she's his grandmother, but he didn't realise that she was his grandmother because there was a whole complicated story about he was brought up by somebody who he thought it was his mother and wasn't.
And people call me a nerd because I know all the different people who've been Captain America. Anyway.
But she's very, very funny as well. Yeah. She's very funny in it.
I saw her in pantomime. She was amazing. Later on the show, as well as Eamon's book about the collapse of EMI, could it have been avoided and who was to blame, we will be discussing other matters, such as the new Netflix horror movie Velvet Buzzsaw, in which the denizens of the Los Angeles art world stumble upon paintings with disturbing attributes and suddenly there are corpses all over the galleries. Can they maintain their ironic detachment? And are rich art ponces the last people in the world we can enjoy being murdered without the slightest pang of guilt? Also, we've got I Trawl the Megahertz by Paddy McAloon, recorded during a period of temporary blindness by the Geordie pop maestro in 2003. This orchestral fantasia is out again, now under the Prefab Sprout name. Is it as good as we recall? And was it right and wrong for pop muses to dabble in the orchestra? This and more after Andrew with a quick reminder.
Big Mouth is, of course, the show that makes your Saturday, but it can make your Friday as well if you help us cover our studio bills. Pledge us a small amount on the crowdfunding platform Patreon, and we will send you each show a day early as soon as it's off the podcasting press. All we're asking for is the equivalent of a price of decently upscale beer each month. That's a mere £5. And we'll send you every show on a Friday, as well as the exclusive extra bit. Every week we record a little bit of additional talk just for Patreon listeners. Will and Eamon are going to stick around to confess to the worst and best people they've interviewed in the trenches of pop journalism. Just search Patreon Big Mouth or go to the Big Mouth Facebook page to find out more. All we're saying is buy us a pint. Let's start off with Velvet Buzzsaw on Netflix. art business satire meets bloody horror movie in this movie by Nightcrawler director Dan Gilroy. It also features his wife, Renee Russo, as well as Jake Gyllenhaal, Zoe Ashton, Toni Collette and John Malkovich. Does it deliver on the front? And how will they get the blood off that Gerhard Richter? Let's have a quick private view.
The artist used blood to create the reddish black.
You ever notice anything about this painting? You look at it long enough, it moves.
There is some sort of power. Some spirit. It's connected to his art. Something truly goddamn strange is going on!
So, Zoe Ashton's character Josephina needs a hit on the art market, and she finds some art by an old dead guy. Her boss, the appalling Rene Russo's Rodora, horns in on it to claim credits, but it turns out the art has powers, and they are bad powers, and they make bad things happen. Will, are you a horror fan?
I am, and I was not a fan of this film.
Oh, really? Why did you not like this film?
I thought it was ridiculous, which obviously is not, you know, it's not a criticism of most horror movies. Mm-hmm. But it kind of annoyed me because, you know, on one level, it was this parody of the art world and you had all these terrible characters. The thing that really bothered me, actually, and I think everyone in this room will have some sympathy for this feeling, is that the guy is an art critic and yet he appears to be a millionaire.
Oh, he's loaded.
And it's like, I'm sorry, but I'm a music journalist and I know, you know, how hard it is to cover the bloody mortgage in, you know, a house in Peckham.
Will, we're in the wrong game. Don't sell the specials album for 28 million quid in Christie's. That's why he's a millionaire.
What?
The crumbs from the rich man's table are as big as your head in the world of art.
Oh,
what I liked about that character was Dick Gyllenhaal was playing the role of Graham Coxon from Blur.
He kind of was. He's got Graham Coxon's glasses.
But the thing that really, the thing that I kind of enjoyed it when I was watching it, but it was one of those films, when it ended, I just thought, oh, God, that's so stupid. Because it seemed to be that they were taking the whole 80s slasher movie thing, where you have some guy who's been, he's had a screwed-up childhood, and then he's taken out on the world, and he's, you know, he's then got supernatural powers to sort of, you know, do terrible things to people. But none of it was actually explained in any way whatsoever. Mm. So you never really found out anything about him. You know, there was like little kind of intimations about what had happened to this guy. But it wasn't developed in that way at all. And so really it seemed to be about presenting us with these terrible characters like the Rene Russo who's sort of sold out because she'd been in a punk band and now she was just...
It's like Courtney Love gone corporate.
But it was really annoying. And I mean, it's one thing to have characters you don't particularly like dying, you know, and in a way that is quite entertaining. But at the same time, I found it clever, but really shallow.
That's probably the reasons I liked it, actually. I mean, I thought the art satire aspect was hilarious. Everybody is trivial and they all have stupid names like Morph and Martilla Splood. It's like they're like characters from Megacity 1. Eamon, what did you think of it? Did you enjoy it?
I liked about the first 2/3 of it because I thought, okay, it's kind of aware of its own ridiculousness. And then the kind of the denouement, it was so over the top. It was so laboured because there's a reference to the character's tattoo. Mm. And I was going, I know how this person's going to die, and that's how they died. And went, are you? Some of it reminded me of those early Peter Jackson horror movies, like
Bad Taste,
and Meet the Feebles, and things like that. That very knowing, ridiculous horror, and
they got so much more character,
violence.
Though. I felt.
Oh no, yeah, but I think it was like this slow, ominous build, and the idea that is this art handed, is the art kind of starting to kill the people. I thought that was quite good, and then it just kind of flipped into this like really clumsy camp, I suppose.
But isn't that you were saying, like you could see the deaths kind of telegraphed ahead?
Yeah.
Isn't that the fun of pulp horror?
This was
a kind of downtown LA fabulously rich version of Don't Go Into That Dark Barn.
Yeah.
Don't go into that dark barn, there's a guy in there with an axe. Oh no, you've gone into the empty art gallery. Oh no, you've done the thing that you're not supposed to do and now you're going to be paid back for it. And what I really enjoyed about it, I loved the campy stupidity of it. I loved the kind of, you know, there's almost two movies in parallel here, isn't there? There's an art world satire, which could well have existed perfectly well without any supernatural murder, and then the supernatural murder as well. Sean, what did you think of it?
I'm with Eamon, and I enjoyed it a lot for the first half or 2/3, and then just thought it's not it's not got enough to it. The shallowness that Will said, there's something about it. It didn't tie up enough ends. There wasn't enough about the artist. The interesting character is John Malkovich, who's the artist who is genuinely tortured by having sold out. He is the only one that has any sort of internal struggle. The rest of them just go along like sort of paperclips, doing what they do, very rich paperclips. And I liked his character a lot and the way that he did that and the end scene about really where he was going, which I won't give away.
Oh, the scene on the beach?
Yes, which I thought was wonderful, and something more could be made of that, maybe. Mm. Morph, the critic, as you say, has no deadlines. He doesn't have an editor telling him what to put
in the... It appears to be all online. He doesn't pay anything.
Oh, right. Yeah, but he also writes what he wants, and as we know, you never write what you want.
You write for a multimillionaire art critic site that has some way of supporting itself that we don't really know what it is.
They could have explained his will by just going, I spot artists really early and buy the stuff and then sell. I get art cheap and then I flog it for a month.
Yeah, that's pointed out.
That could have been like within 2 seconds ago. This explains my lifestyle.
Too buff for a journalist.
What
can I say? It's the art world, darling. It's not like us.
The main thing that annoyed me about it was that I felt, you know, I love stupid horror movies. I mean, get me on Dr. Butcher MD, Medical Deviant, and I'm a happy man. But, you know, I felt this was really knowing. And it was, you know, it's like those early Peter Jackson films like Bad Taste are brilliant because he's obviously a fan of that stuff. And I just felt, and they're kind of, they've got this great character to it. Whereas for me, this was, it was like, it felt like it was just made by the kind of people who I really didn't want to end up being stuck in a room with.
So my suspicion was that obviously, there's an all-star cast here, partly because the director has amazing connections and has made Nightcrawler, which is one of your favourites.
Which I love Nightcrawler.
Yeah. That's a great film. Yeah, I love Nightcrawler.
So there's an all-star cast here, but I suspect that part of the reason is because they quite like the idea of being in a movie where mocking the kind of art scene idiots that they have to hang around with at openings.
Oh, God, you know,
all horror films are revenge, and in the kind of in the 60s and 70s, the revenge was on the kind of bourgeois nuclear family as ordinary people were tortured and torn to bits. Now the people we want revenge on are people who stand around with a glass of immensely expensive wine, looking sideways at Gerhard Richter.
Yeah, but those films, I mean, even if you look at Driller Killer or whatever, or you know, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the ultimate classic, they've got this kind of weird authenticity, however ridiculous they are. And for me, I think it was a little bit like if someone had made... Do you remember that programme about the music journalism or the music industry called... that Mick Jagger had something to do with vinyl. It's a bit like that, where it's like totally inauthentic. And I just felt the inauthenticity. It's like campness is fine, but it's got to have some sense of reality, you know, some sense of truth to it.
I think we're very much watching a Netflix film, though, where all the corners have been rounded off because it's got to appeal to as many people. And when you compare it with films that are in the cinema now, like The Favourite is a really weird film.
It's a really good point.
Bloody bizarre. And so what we've got is cinema going one way, and films that are going to get theatrical release are actually pushing things and becoming far stranger. Mm. And Netflix is going, hey, we're Disney. And I think we're seeing the Disneyfication of this particular film. It may have had a more interesting draft, but somehow it's been boxed into something else. And so it's more palatable.
It's got to appeal to multiple demographics simultaneously. Yeah, yeah.
It's almost the hipsterification as well. So it's like we're assuming our audience are very culturally savvy.
Yeah.
And they get the irony of it all. And I felt, again, that's kind of... There's something about it which I feel doesn't respect the audience. You know, it's not really someone's real vision in the way that the things you really love have that weirdness, like you say.
Yeah. I think that's a bit unfair because he has, you know, something read around it. This is quite a passion project for him. He's clearly spent a lot of time in this world, and I liked the fact that, I mean, you know, I don't go to art openings and, you know, meet with people who are talking about, you know, the liminal specification of the reification of the unreal and all this kind of stuff, but it rang true to me because I think it rings true to him. And was kind of, to me, it was, you know, the point of it is not so much you know, can we create a functioning horror film here. The point is, can you make those characters seem comically real? And it kind of worked for me in a way it just seems to not work for you at all.
I just felt they're stereotypes.
I just felt that the ending was, it felt like somebody had basically just said, okay, you've got this subtle ending, let's just go all camp guns blazing on this.
But that's horror, isn't it? You have to go all guns blazing.
Yeah, but I think they probably... Because there were little bits of that kind of looming sense of dread and stuff like that. There was little bits, little flickers on the... on some of the paintings and go, are the paintings alive and stuff like that. And there was this kind of creeping sense of dread all the way through. And then just the last bit, it just seemed a bit heavy-handed.
A classic horror film that makes absolutely no sense, when you've no understanding of why this is happening, The Shining. Why does it happen to that guy? We never understand the forces behind it. We never understand, you know, what set this train of events in motion. Only is his own psychosis.
No, but I feel that with that, whatever, you know, whether it's real, imagined, you know, it's, you get the psychology of the character. And what you really get with The Shining, I feel, is the sense of isolation and frustration and losing your mind. Whereas for this, I didn't get any of that. I mean, at the moment the monkeys jumped out of the painting and started struggling, I thought, okay.
Yeah. Paul Parra. Well, I liked it. 1 out of 4 ain't
Fair
bad.
Enough.
Not bad at all.
I like 2/3 of it.
Okay, there you go. So that adds up to 1.7, 1.66 out of 4. All right.
I'm sure a listener will tell us.
Yes.
Okay, let's tear ourselves away from contemplating the intense liminal suspension of the severed head. It's time for some music, chosen by one of our guests, Will Hodgkinson. What is your editor's recommendation?
It is a band called Black Country New Road, who are part of this whole thing. And I think Eamon's going to talk about a band called Black Midi, who are a fantastic band, and they're really blowing up. But there seems to be, like, a few years ago, remember the Fat White Family was this huge influence, and there were all these bands coming out of South London which were kind of punky and grungy. Now things have developed a bit, and there seems to be all of these bands, really young, who can play their instruments, but they've got great ideas, unusual. They've got really good taste in music, really interesting taste, and they're sort of doing this weird mix of, like, new wave, no wave, post-punk, a lot of jazz in there. So this band are a six-piece, three men, three women. They've got violin, they've got saxophone, they do all this spoken word. It's kind of very pretentious. It's called Athens, France, with an apostrophe, which doesn't seem to make a great deal of sense. But it's just one of those weird, interesting songs. And also, my son went to see them at the Windmill, and I was banned from seeing them because I can't be seen in the same place as him. These are his laws, not mine, obviously. So, you know, but he came back and he was so excited. And I just remember that feeling of when I was 17 and finding this little scene where there's all these interesting bands playing and there's no distance between the band and the audience. Half the audience are in bands. Mm.
Yeah. But if you'd gone, they would have gone. It's amazing. Al Cooper came to see us. Al Cooper from 1973 came
I don't
to
think
see
they'd
us.
Know who Al Cooper was. They'd just see, he's that weird old guy at the back.
I think key to that scene is Speedy Wonderground, the label. Because yeah, I think that tracks on it. That. And they're doing these kind of amazing one-off singles, a bit like, I guess, Fierce Panda would have been in the 90s, putting out kind of knock-kneed indie stuff. They're doing this kind of weird art rock stuff and just sounding really interesting acts.
Great. It's Athens, France by Black Country New Road.
She flies to Paris, France. I come down in her childhood bed. She tries to fuck me. I pretend that I'm asleep instead. She loves pop culture. She has thank you next stuck in her head. The cursed vultures give me sourdough, my daily bread. I want to find out what it's like.
Now, is it possible to discuss the end of a beloved music institution without somebody somewhere using the topical and up-to-date headline, The Day the Music Died? The EMI Records empire was home to Pink Floyd, Radiohead, Coldplay, Robbie Williams, Blair, and popular Merseyside four-piece The Beatles. Well done, The Beatles. Will the chaos of the early noughties hold it below the waterline, whereupon it was acquired for £4.2 billion by hedge fund Terra Firma in 2007. Thus began one of the most painful and embarrassing episodes in music business history, in which EMI was subjected to endless reorganisation and finally dismembered, and Terra Firma's Guy Hans lost his metaphorical shirt. Could it have gone another way? What does it all mean? Eamon Ford has literally written the book on the subject, and we're going to talk about it after What Else? The Sex Pistols with the AMI. There you go.
It's an unlimited supply, and there is no reason why. I tell you, it was all a frame. They only did it because of fame. Support us. An unlimited amount.
Evidently, there isn't an unlimited supply. Eamon, Where does the EMI deal stand in the pantheon of music business bad deals? Is it up at the top? Is it the Elvis of terrible deals?
It probably is. And I spoke to Guy Hand and I put a quote to him that someone, I think it was the Telegraph, they referred to it. I should actually point out that Terra Firma are a private equity company, not a hedge fund.
Okay,
so,
sorry.
So for legal reasons.
Whatever.
but I put a quote to him when I interviewed him for the book, and I said, someone described this as the worst private equity deal of all time. How do you respond? And he said, well, you look at the evidence, and yeah, it was. It was the worst private equity deal of all time.
I mean, it is a business book. There's a lot of percentages and
there's
and
a lot of numbers.
But it does have a really strong narrative of basically creative people come up against the Zoots and the Money Men and get a horrible bucket of cold water thrown over them. Was it that simple? I mean, the AMI creators seem to have been maybe a little bit too creative and had maybe a little bit too much of a free hand on the budgets, perhaps.
This is the issue, because obviously EMI was to be bought in 2007. EMI recorded music, not EMI Publishing. EMI Publishing was a very successful part of the business, the biggest music publisher in the world. But recorded was in not good shape, because you were 7 years into a 14-year decline in terms of revenues for record companies. Everyone was suffering. EMI was the weakest of the four majors. EMI was also historically incredibly weak in America, the biggest music market in the world. So EMI was at a double disadvantage compared to the other major record companies at that time. So EMI absolutely was ripe for reinvention, and certainly the executives, the senior people that I spoke to at EMI at that time would agree that we were not in good shape. It was because America was just dragging the numbers down. EMI in the UK was profitable and successful. EMI in Europe was profitable and successful, but America was just a money pit, and that's where a lot of the losses were coming from, and that's where a lot of the profit warnings were being derived from. So EMI was not in a healthy shape in 2007.
Without giving away too many spoilers, they in Terra Firma, they fall into the hands of people who are kind of self-styled reinvention experts. And there's a very funny bit where Terra Firma executives are running around the AMI buildings shouting about the toilets. And the reason is that they'd taken over a German service station empire, which was known for having terrible toilets.
Yeah.
And they'd fixed the toilets and made the toilets clean and turned it into a success. Yeah. And consequently, they thought this was the key to everything. Fix the toilets.
Well,
shouting at Paul McCartney. What are the toilets in your business, Macca? Pet Shop Boys, what are the toilets?
Love me poo. No, let's not do that.
Being for the benefit of Mr.
The Terra Firma had their model was, and to give them credit, they were not just asset strippers. People could have come in, just torn EMI apart. Their model was to kind of take an ailing business and spend 7 years investing in it, turn it around, cutting overhead, and then sell it for a profit. And that was their plan with EMI. I'd kind of seen some of their forecasts from 2007 into 2014. So they weren't going to go in and try and do this kind of quick fix thing. But they had come off two quite big successful things. They were in the middle of turning around the Odeon at that point, and this German service station chain was called Tank und Rast. And that was people, they found that in Germany people wouldn't stop there because the toilets were filthy. And then they did this whole thing where people could get a refund. They would pay for the toilets, which was, I think, was illegal under German laws, but they had some voucher thing where you could get money off food. So then all of those concessions chains would come in, and they spent 7 years fixing it. But yeah, it fundamentally came down to changing the German drivers' experience or perception of this thing, which was, this place has got filthy toilets. They changed that. People started to stop there. They were obviously making money from the concession stands, all that sort of stuff, and it was a massive successful business. So they were coming off not a glamorous restructuring of a company, but a massively successful one.
Yeah, but it's kind of, in a way, I was surprised at how sorry I started to feel for Terra Firma, because they're trying to apply what in their world is best business practice. Yeah. They introduce a lot of interesting things, such as market research onto the entire spread of music buyers to see where various bands slot in and who their buyers are and who their buyers aren't. But they make this terrible mistake of going to the artists and the managers and saying, well, you know, we see your buyer as being a kind of a top shop guy who buys a 50-year-old bloke who buys chinos, and the bands don't want to hear this. They don't
some are happy to do those kind of endorsements, but those kind of brand deals, that's part and parcel of a big kind of major label deal. Some of the stuff they put in, that kind of audience insights and analysis and stuff, is now standard practice in the music industry. So the outside view is, oh, they bought, they spent 4 billion quid buying this company and they messed it up, ha ha. But they were actually doing good stuff. I think the real narrative, I think, is this is it's an example of the worst time possible, because they bought a company 7 years into a 14-year decline across the industry. Worst time to buy a company. They'd also taken out a £2.6 billion loan, which was then the subject of two court cases from Citigroup, yeah. Just at the point where the global financial markets crashed and also the debt markets crashed, because Citigroup's yeah. model was, we will lend you £2.6 billion, but we will sell off chunks of that on the debt market to people. It's a spread bet for us. We're not responsible yeah. for the 2.6. The debt markets have collapsed. So Citigroup were now going, okay, we're in this for 2.6 billion. And they were putting pressure on Terra Firma to deliver results and meet their debt covenants. Mm. And at that point, just the state of the music industry, because they were forecasting, Terra Firma were forecasting that the record industry would go into recovery in 2014, which it did. Mm. They were absolutely spot on that. But I think the first year was a wasted year because they got rid of all the senior execs at a board level at EMI, and Guy Hans became CEO. He says by his own admission under duress, because he was not CEO. So that first year was wasted, I think. Yeah. They didn't know what they were doing. Second year, they were starting to put the pieces in place. Third year, EMI was actually doing really good stuff and they just ran out of road.
Mm. One of the surprising things is that the artists don't always come out of this covered in glory. And there's a moment where the Radiohead in Rainbows moment, yeah. where they basically spring it upon EMI, who supported them, you know, for many years in development, yeah. said, actually, we're going to put out ourselves and actually we're going to give it away on a tip jar model, yeah. and actually you're not getting it. Mm-hmm. Radiohead don't really come out of this particularly well, do they? But then neither do the new EMI, who then immediately tried to spoiler it with a fairly trashy best of compilation.
And a box out of the previous album. Yeah, well, Radiohead were out of contract. I think the previous album would be like 3 or 4 years before that, but they were in negotiations with EMI, could we do something? It's obviously going to be some kind of new business model. EMI had formed with that famous Robbie Williams deal, where they got a cut of all of his earnings, which is now standard yeah. practice for major label deals. And Radiohead were negotiating, but also Radiohead knew that the In Rainbows was kind of coming up. And I know that they were meeting with the very senior people at EMI in the UK, talking about, they'd heard, they didn't know it was called In Rainbows, but they'd basically heard the album a matter of weeks before that they released it that way. So EMI was still negotiating in good faith that, okay, we can do something. There is, maybe we give them the rights back to previous albums, maybe we give them the rights back to 2 albums for every 1 album they deliver. There's a deal to be done. But simultaneously, Radiohead had been putting this very complex plan in place to do something like that. Wasn't something they dreamt up overnight. It was lots and lots of months. There was a huge big issue to do with taking them out of the PRS for collective licensing, which is a very boring thing, but that was, they had to get in a woman called Jane Dibble, who was at Warner Chappell, their publisher, for years, and she negotiated this complex thing because PRS had this issue about you have to have a minimum dealer price and stuff like that. You can't let people just pay. So they had to take the rights out for that particular reason in that moment. And that was months and months of very, very complex negotiations. They didn't spring it on people, but they were also discussing with Tony Wadsworth, who was head of EMI in the UK, and Keith Wozencroft, who was the guy who signed them when they yeah. were on Friday. And so they thought that they were, they said, oh, we know you're speaking to other labels, we want to come up with some sort of deal. Mm. But they didn't know they were planning this, and Radiohead were running kind of 2 presences, I suppose. Yeah. They've got this secret kind of circle of trust, of which there was probably only about 5 or 6 people involved. It was basically the band and management and 1 or 2 kind of business licensing experts involved in this. And then they were probably, I'm sure they were speaking to other labels as well, but that was I think the term that was referred to when it actually dropped was the phrase that was used a lot was betrayal. They felt that yeah. they'd really sold Tony Wadsworth in particular down the river on this one.
Yeah. Guy Hans, I was surprised at how sorry I felt for Guy Hans in this, and for some of the people that work with him. He seems such an incredibly awkward individual, and he's introduced to the staff and he tells them that his favourite band is the Sex Pistols, but actually secretly...
Oh, no, he wanted to say that it was the Sex Pistols, and he thought, oh, that's a bit obvious, and then he talks about...
The Mac Lads.
They are genuinely his favourite band.
You kind of think, you know, and he talks about his dyslexia and the ordeal of going through the Citigroup court case, where he's absolutely eviscerated and torn to pieces.
Yeah.
And you look at it and you think, how is this guy a multimillionaire? He seems very, very multi-billionaire. He seems very fragile. emotionally unintelligent, lacking in the ability to make, to see the position of other people. And yet he's fabulously rich and successful.
He kind of came up through, what was the Japanese bank? Nomura, I think.
Yeah.
He was like, in the 80s, he was like this whiz kid finance guy. I think he had basically, like, he'd come up with whole new approaches to kind of raising capital and turning companies around and so forth. He's incredibly good at the numbers side of things. He, by his own admission, when I spoke to him, he said that he should never have been the CEO, but they got rid of the previous CEO, Eric Nicolai, very soon after the deal had gone through. And you can't just suddenly find a global CEO overnight. It took them a year to find a guy who came from the brands world called Elio Leone Schetti. But so Guy was kind of running the company, and he said that he'd never been a CEO before, and by his own admission, and he didn't do a good job. And I think he learned very quickly not to speak to the artists and speak to managers because he couldn't speak to them in that language. Yeah. It's a very, there's a lot of kind of politics in dealing with those artists. So somebody like Tony Wadsworth at EMI was an absolute expert in that. He could speak to musicians as musicians, but also kind of work on a business level. And those are very, very rare skills, being able to kind of balance kind of the art and commerce and understanding the tensions of both and trying to find a compromise. And I think Terra Firma didn't understand just how political the relationships are. There's also a counter argument that EMI had kind of cosseted its artists and indulged them and let them get away with stuff. So maybe the artists and the managers there feel that they could just kind of get EMI to bend to their will.
Yeah.
And obviously Terra Firma were going, okay, it's not, bottom line is the numbers. We need to introduce a new way of dealing with that. And it took them a long time to learn to speak the language of artists.
What surprised you most while you were writing it? What?
Oh, God. I think there was a lot of, there was a very kind of reductive narrative and a lot of, ha-ha, these guys lost a shirt, boo-hoo, the corporate guys. I think Terra Firma genuinely went in with good intentions. They went about it, certainly for the first year and a bit, in the wrong way. They genuinely wanted to help EMI. They could have very easily just sold off EMI Publishing for a fortune, but they were kind of investing in turning this company around. I was kind of surprised how little kind of due diligence they did, because they came in really late to the bid, and they came in like maybe 6 weeks, 2 months before the bid and closed on EMI. So they had to go through and run the numbers on this and go, right, okay, right, we'll pay this and this is what we'll do. And I think by their own admission, they didn't have enough time to do that, because it was also they'd come off the back of raising a load of money to buy something and they just missed out on Boots. Like literally weeks beforehand, they had put in a bid to take over Boots, and they got so they had 200 investors, including the Canadian Teachers Fund, were one of their investors, who had put in 1.6 billion, and then they borrowed 2.6 billion from Citi to make up the 4.2 billion. And it was really bad timing. It was like everything. It's kind of a classic example of when not to buy a company.
Yeah. So it sounds like they're impetuous and they don't do their due diligence. We can sell them a small podcasting company. So the fall of EMI, Selling the Pig, it's out now. And so, well, it's not out now. It's out at the end of this month.
21st of February.
Available
yes.
in all good bookshops near you very, very soon.
Okay, time to stop calculating the earnings before interest, tax, depreciation, and have we earned our advance yet out, guys? Let's have some more music. It's Andrew's choice for a change. What have you got today?
Well, the listeners will be stunned and surprised to learn that it's the Pet Shop Boys. Give Stupidity a Chance. A surprise Pet Shop Boys track came out this week, which makes me very excited. And it's topical. It's about the now. It's a song for the moment. Who does that anymore? Who releases songs that are about what's happening this very, very minute? The Pet Shop Boys don't really have hits anymore these days, so they don't have to try and have a hit. They can just put out the song that they want to. Nobody else could do this. And also what I love about Give Stupidity a Chance, which is clearly about the world of Brexit and Trump and the debasement of political leadership, but also kind of the debasement of conversation amongst the public, is that you're not really supposed to call the other side stupid. You're not supposed to, you know, you're supposed to go, yes, legitimate concerns, yes, left behind, yes, don't be arrogant and say that people don't know what they're talking about. Well, the Pet Shop Boys are saying, yes, there is stupidity out there, and unfortunately we're giving it a chance. I think the opening lines are, intelligent people have had their say. It's time for the foolish to lead the way. So here we go. This is the Pet Shop Boys with Give Stupidity a Chance.
Yeah. Intelligent people have had their say. It's time for the foolish to show the way. Let's leave this wild, a merry dance. Let's give stupidity a chance. We've heard quite enough of experts and their dealings. Why face the facts when you can just feel our feelings? Let's leave this world a merry dance. Let's give stupidity a chance.
Finally, in the early 2000s, Paddy McAloon of Prefab Sprout began to lose his sight as the result of a detached retina. Unable to work, he fell into the world of shortwave radio, listening to broadcasts from across the world, and it inspired an extravagant orchestral work that he called I Trawl the Megahertz. It was rather cruelly overlooked at the time, but subsequently gained a reputation as a bona fide cult classic. Now it's been re-released this week under the Prefab Sprout name for the first time, and Paddy has had his sight mostly back as well. He's grown a big beard, though, in the meantime. Here's a bit of the title track.
I am telling myself the story of my life, stranger and song of fiction. We start with the joyful mysteries before the appearance of ether, trying to capture the elusive. The farm where the crippled horses heal, the woods where autumn is reversed, and the longing for bliss in the arms.
Can you hear us, Radio Tirana? Eamon Ford, what's your favourite cosmic snail jazz orchestral album inspired by shortwave radio and written and directed by a blind man?
I think it might be this.
Oh, tell us more.
Troll and the Magalols. No, it's not. It's not.
Nice.
I listened to this, excuse the pun, blind, because I didn't know the context of it. I kind of went, okay, this is quite interesting experiment. And then I read the background to this, kind of the reasons for this. And then suddenly you go, right, okay, I get it now. Because, like, I think if you just listened, if you came to it and you didn't know the backstory, and this is kind of important part of the whole thing, and kind of that idea of just I'm going to go in with audio and I'm just going to find what's out on the kind of the outer reaches of the radio waves was really interesting. And that idea of kind of blindness and sight being deteriorated, what it really reminded me of was, here we go, Pants Alert, Derek Jarman's Blue.
Oh,
so that whole thing, because that was obviously about him having treatment for HIV, and this was, I think, blue was the colour that he used to see when he when he got droplets on his eyes, and then obviously that started as a radio thing, and then he just did the film Blue, which just had that was just the blue, and I was going, like, there's clearly a kind of parallel there, because it's about what happens when vision goes. And I don't know, maybe I'm grasping at straws there, but that was the immediate thing I thought of. And I think you really need to understand the context to get what he's doing and why it resonates.
You need the background.
And then when you do, it's a whole different listen. I listened to it once and kind of went, okay, this is quite good. It's a bit kind of ambient and whatever. And then context, you go, oh, right. I see exactly what he's doing. And then it becomes much more kind of emotionally affected. And I thought it was, like, the music is beautiful as well. Mm. And it is, for the most part, instrumental. Although the first track's like 22 minutes long, and it's all spoken word. Well, there's background music. But it, like, obviously, to have the opening track on your album be kind of 20-minute freeform jazz with classical, and then someone talking about finding stuff on the radio is a really bold piece of work. Mm. It's beautiful as well, I thought.
Will, shortwave radio is pretty much obsolete. Does this add a poignancy? And what did you think of the record? Had you heard it before?
No, I never heard it before. And I reviewed it, I think, a couple of weeks ago. So I was listening to it and I was thinking, this is absolutely beautiful. That first track, what really, really got me, and it's a very sad album, really, but what really affected me was there's these little radio phone-ins which have been taken from it. And there's one where there's a guy saying, I've divorced, and he's saying, are you feeling lost? Yes, I'm feeling very lost. And you just felt the complete loneliness of sort of 2 a.m. radio phone-in. Mm. People, you know, people all over, I'm assuming Britain, you know, because they're mostly British voices, who are, you know, feeling totally alone. And that's what it captures. So I was interested to learn about the backstory that Paddy McAloon had had this awful situation where I think his retinas had been detached.
Yeah. Yes.
Just horrific. Yes. And he'd had all kinds of health problems. And, I mean, that was interesting because I remember people having... I remember seeing that album, Steve McQueen, in people's record collections. And he's very, very romantic cover, very good-looking guy on a motorbike, and it's all dust, you know, kind of, you know, slightly rainy. And then about 10 or 15 years ago, I interviewed Paddy McAloon, and he did not look like that at all. He's
this kind looks like Alan Moore now.
Yeah, he did. He's like, wow, who's this old man of the woods? Lovely, lovely man. Very, very bright, very interesting. And so I found that interesting that, you know, someone who initially had seemed to me like a kind of Ian McCulloch, good-looking, slightly alternative pop star guy, had gone down this very unusual route. But the album, I just thought I think it's beautiful. I don't think it's an album I'd want to hear if I was feeling desperately sad. Okay. I think it would kind of make things worse. But it's like one of those albums it's worth listening to the whole way through, not doing anything else. You know, I don't think this is something to have on while you're doing the cooking.
I had it on while I was doing the cooking. But I was cooking something that turned up very sad. Fine.
I like that point you're making about the kind of the 2 a.m. and that kind of sense of dislocation was, and it's another Blue reference, Chris Morrison Blue Jam. That was the vibe that he was going for as well. Because he was going, it's that bit where kind of dreamness and wakeness kind of start to merge.
Absolutely.
And everything's a bit dislocated and everything just feels a bit like you're kind of wading through treacle or something. And it had that vibe. It had very much that it's 2 o'clock, everybody else is in bed. These are the last people awake.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Andrew, did you listen to it on your fancy pants speakers?
I did listen on my fancy pants speakers.
And how does it sound?
It sounded unbelievably beautiful and hallucinogenic and totally enveloping. I did know this record inside out, actually, because remember I was working on the Word magazine when it turned up and said, oh, Paddy McAloon, here we go, hot dog, jumping frog, Albuquerque, here we go. Lines in my own garden, pop tune, 3-minute pop tunes, and you fall into this kind of 22-minute honey bath of strings and sort of distant cornets and these disembodied fragments of voices, and you're not entirely sure whether it's the story of Paddy's own life, whether the female narrator is saying, you know, phrases coming out like, your daddy loves you very much, he just doesn't want to live with us anymore.
It's agonising.
Is this Paddy's own story? Has he written it? Has he pulled it, culled it from what he's heard on the radio? Very, very poetic. What it reminded me of is Dennis Potter. That you're looking
a
at
singing detective.
Blue Remembered Hills.
There's lots of blue jam, Blue Remembered Hills.
On the fancy speakers, though, because I've been loaned a set of speakers by Dali, our friends at Dali loudspeakers.
Yes, can you loan me some?
My God, I was absolutely just dissolved and blown away. It's like Debussy discovering the Orban jazz at the same time. It does feel like late night radio.
Debussy to a disco beat.
with
a phrase.
Debussy without the disco beat. To me, it felt of a piece with the kind of late career I no longer care, therefore I am free type records, such as Apple Venus by XTC, Andy Partridge's amazing kind of summation of what he's all about, or even Scott Walker's Tilt, which is a really, really difficult listen.
But this is the human, enjoyable...
Without slapping
I didn't find it. So obviously the Scott Walker thing, but the thing I really got from it is, you know, I was saying I found it very, very sad. But there's something about sad music, beautifully done, which is warm music as well. And so it's almost like, you know, I can imagine on some fantastic speakers, there's something about, you know, it's a bit like kind of, you know, it's frosty outside and it's warm inside. It's like, it's a bit like being an open, you know, it's a melancholia to it. Yeah. So although it is sad, it's also somehow very, very, very warming album.
A very human album as well.
It is. And I think it makes a lot of the sentiment that is conveyed in conventional pop and rock structures seem rather callow and artificial. They don't actually seem like they're by real people. They seem like they're by musicians trying to conjure up a feeling. Mm. And this feels like real human beings sort of wafting in and out of you in this great kind of warm wind of orchestras and, the occasional very, very tiny electric guitar distant twang.
Yeah.
But there's only one song, Sleeping Rough, that he sings on, and that was kind of like a bolt from the blue. Yeah. It kind of wakes you up from the reverie, doesn't it? It's towards the end. Yeah. It's Paddy. Oh, it's him. Oh, of course. Oh. And suddenly that rush of memory of Prefab Sprout Records thing comes in. And what does he sing? He sings, I Am Lost. It's like a children's book in that way. You know, you get to really sad.
Yeah.
Sad part where the bear's on the boat.
For the anniversary reissue, I hope they do a 3-CD reissue, which is the album as is, mm-hmm. then just an album with the music, because the music on its own is beautiful, yeah. and then another CD with just the speech stuff, because you miss bits and pieces,
yeah.
because it's that point where the kind of the speech and the music start to fold into each other, and you're kind of you're drifting in and out of it. So just to yeah. actually hear those things in isolation would be really nice as well, because just the orchestration is astonishing yes. on this album.
It reminded me of that Matt Johnson doc that we watched about him just sitting on the sofa not being able to do anything but listening to the radio yeah. and a kind of a pop star of a certain age when you just really don't know what to do with
actually,
yourself. It was
when
that
you could listen
pinpoint.
To a detuned radio, because now that all radios are digital and it just finds the station, bingo.
Oh, I think you yeah, can still get a bit of. I've got.
It's kind of hard to get radio to run these days.
You know what it also reminded me of? It was a little bit like if you're on the bus or on the train or something, and you just hear little snatches of people's conversation.
Mm. Yeah. That was the
and
whole burial thing.
Yeah,
was
and then every now and then it's actually. You know, you kind of you get a little glimpse into someone's life, and it's quite sad. You know, that's yeah. that's sort of what I felt.
Yeah. Well, actually, that's and I think entertaining idea though a 3-CD edition yeah. is. I think being able to hear the voices is kind of wrong. I think that's missing
right.
the point.
You
it's
need them be, embedded.
It's embedded in there.
Yeah.
yeah.
And that's what brings you back and makes you listen.
You capture
again.
Them and you lose them. I think yeah. that's part of the appeal.
I'm so, just lazy. I just like to hear.
So as far as we know, Paddy is living his quiet life. He's happy, wife
that's
and
good.
Kids.
Yep.
Do we want him to be a bit more maverick? Have some heartache? Do a bit more stuff
no.
like this?
Oh, well, God, if this is like basically a concept album about almost losing your sight, I think that's kind of
yeah, that's
sad
too,
enough,
too
really.
Yeah.
That's kind of I mean, enough heart on sleeve exactly. or retina on sleeve. Yeah.
But I would like him to do much more like this, because I like it when, again, I mean, mentioned Andy Partridge. I wish Andy Partridge would work more. I'd like it when great pop artists realise they don't have to make pop anymore and they can just spiral away.
They can just go off and do their own world. Thing.
Noodle.
Finally, before we finish up, it's Eamon Ford's turn to choose a track. And he's gone for one of those bands he's obsessed with again. What have you brought in, Eamon Ford?
It is the second single by Black Midi. It's got a weird release because there's an extended version that's got other songs and remixes and stuff. But there's a song called Speedway, which is not sung by the main singer. I believe it's the bassist
right.
sings this. And it's kind of it's slightly spoken word, I suppose. And it's not this kind of crazy kind of post-punk kind of noise that they'd had kind of with like insane jazz drums on top of it that you might have known from the single Bim 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 that I brought in last year.
Many times.
Yes, yeah. Yes, many times.
Are they on Rough Trade now?
They have so just signed just because signed. I've yeah. been to see them twice in 3 days, so they played Block, which had
yeah, wait
the,
for that one. Yeah.
Which was, had the most insane security check ever. Did you have to go through, like, you were suddenly in
queue? It's like going to Bagley's in the 90s. It was like some club where they're taking drugs off you and then selling them back to you or something.
Allegedly.
Allegedly.
People had chewing gum, and that's not a euphemism, genuine packets of chewing gum taken off
them. It was crazy, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, and it took forever.
It felt, I thought there was something sinister about that. I just thought there was something wrong here, you know.
So I saw them on that Friday, and then I saw them at the Windmill as part of Independent Venue Week on Monday, and I'm standing right beside Jeff Travis. So I think he'd just signed them that week.
Fantastic.
So album in the summer, I believe. But they're just and they play this kind of weird art rock noise, and then at the end of the Windmill set, they just went into this kind of blues workout, to almost like to go right. Okay, we can still do what you expect a band to do, which was kind of quite funny.
Okay,
there we go. Well, let's have a listen.
So they do have a sense of humour. Bless them.
Okay. They do have a sense of humour. Right, let's have a listen. Shut up, Eamon. We're going to listen to it. This is Speedway by Black Midi.
Build this crown on floodplain, needly water and dog shit park, new city, old buildings, council going, missing tonight, to live next to the game, new flats.
It's the end of the show, which means closing time chatter. What will our guests be discussing over a wasabi martini as they wait to get murdered in a gallery in Silver Lake? Will Hutchinson, what's your closing time chatter?
I would like to talk about someone called Leslie Weiner. She was a supermodel, sort of the first androgynous supermodel, allegedly. You know, that was her thing. And she was in New York. This would have been in the 1980s. Very, very cool, very sort of, you know, real that kind of downtown figure. So she's mates with Basquiat and she's mates with William Burroughs and all these people. And she got very disillusioned with the, I guess, the shallowness of the fashion world. And she started making music. And she made this amazing album called Witch, which I think she made in 1990. But it didn't come out until 1993. It got completely buried because for some reason it didn't come out under her own name. It came under the copyright sign, C. Which is like, you know, there's no way of knowing.
Very hard to Google.
Very hard to Google. Yeah. And Google hadn't been invented yet. So it was... It was a brilliant record. It's sort of by mistake, she invented trip hop. It sounds like trip hop to me. It's really,
when did this happen?
1990.
Yeah. I think I remember this.
Yeah, it's an amazing, amazing record. But she now lives in France. She is, you know, this fascinating character. She's married and she's living in rural France, you know, kind of away from everything. She was a big influence on Madonna, funnily enough. And Sean Penn used to love her, you know, and he would play her at parties. But the album came out, did nothing. She didn't know anything about trip hop. This is before Blue Lines. And it wasn't her intention at all. All she was doing was kind of talking, mainly this kind of... you know, the sort of things that she'd experienced and, you know, things about sexism in the fashion world, all this kind of stuff, objectified. Yeah. And then she was not really a musician, so she was just making stuff on computers as, you know, what you could do at the time. And it's very simple, but very unusual, very downbeat and very interior. And Light in the Attic is one of my favourite labels, a great American reissue label. They are putting out Leslie Winer. I think it's going to be the first album with whatever else they can get their hands on later on this year. Mm. So for me, that is very exciting. I mean, and I didn't know her at the time. I've only discovered her recently. But everything I read about her, she's a great character. Very, you know, very kind of quite a difficult character, but you know, brilliant and. Sort of, you know, said absolutely no one was interested in my music whatsoever. Apparently, she said at one point someone described it as lesbian dub, and she's not a lesbian, and she's not making dub. So she liked that.
Although, you know, to be fair, if you went into a record shop and there was a category in one of the racks called lesbian dub, you'd
have a look,
wouldn't you?
You'd at least have a look. Yeah, yeah. So she's a little fascination of mine right now, and I really like the music. I haven't really heard anything like it.
Fantastic. Well, we'll keep an eye out for that, though. Presumably, we'll be bigging it up in the Times when it finally comes out.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not coming out until the autumn because it's so difficult to get this staff. And, you know, and also Light in the Attic always do really, really nice editions. Fantastic. So there's you know, they want to do really good, you know, really good liner notes and get interviews with her and everything. So, but it's happening. And I don't know, I mean, I don't think she'll be playing gigs again, but you never know.
Make a note, listeners. Sounds good. Eamon, what's your closing time chapter?
Oh, mine's very sad, actually. I'm going to bring everybody down. I want to talk about Dave Lang, who was my PhD supervisor between 1998 and 2001, and he passed away in January, and he was basically this kind of giant of kind of music academia and also business writing in the UK. He wrote a book at the end of the 60s called The Sound of Our Time, which basically set out the stall for the academic study of popular music in the UK. So everything that kind of came after that, people like Simon Frith was one of his contemporaries, but Dave Lang was there first. He wrote a really important book in the early 80s called One Chord Wonders about kind of politics and punk rock music and kind of filtering that through an academic lens. He was one of the great obituary writers for The Guardian as well. He was like, those kind of great big detailed obituaries on kind of obscure musicians. He was just this walking encyclopedia. He worked for Music Week. He worked for Music Business International. He was a research fellow at Westminster and Liverpool and so forth. And obviously, when you do a PhD, you have this very kind of intense relationship with someone. It's just one person who you're dealing with, who's kind of seeing the inside of your head. And he was just this kind of incredible brain, but with also zero arrogance as well. He was like, he just wanted to kind of... could help people. He was always kind of any kind of new academics coming through, he was really keen to kind of help them and guide them and stuff. He was basically human Wikipedia before Wikipedia. He had read everything and he knew everything, and he didn't have kind of any arrogance at all. And he was just a great man.
Fantastic. Okay, Sian, what's your closing idea?
Well, I went to this amazing gig on Friday. I think Will was the special. Great. HMV that we were talking about a couple of weeks ago has been saved, quote unquote saved. 100 stores are going to be saved, 27 are going to go, which includes the Bond Street store.
Yeah, the big famous one on Oxford Street with the lovely...
Dog listening to the gramophone. That's going to go.
It's remarkable that that one's not viable of all of the ones.
I think the rent on Oxford Street is just ridiculous.
But you think the footfall would be pretty high. Anyway, I think it's a good news story. Can we be happy that Sports Direct haven't bought it? Can we be happy that it's going to save some fops as
every time you buy a record from HMV, at least you won't get a gigantic HMV mug stuck in your order, whether you like it or not.
Yeah, the car sticker.
£3
Because what's it? Is it Sunshine? The guy who runs a Canadian chain.
Sunrise Records.
Sunrise, yes. So it's obviously someone who works in music retail, and there's a direct parallel, if you want to, between Terra Firma and EMI, and that mismatch between those cultures. Mm-hmm. It's good that you've got someone who understands the business and will have an element of sympathy. Obviously, they know that obviously they're closing stores, and that's. Is part and parcel of a problem of a company going into near liquidation. But hopefully they've got a recovery plan, as they say.
Well, good news for Alanis Morissette, Neil Young. Who else is Canadian? They won't be at the front of the rack.
Johnny Mitchell.
Comes to HMV, eh? Anyway.
Brian Adams.
What's that all about?
Sorry to any Canadians listening.
Canadian racism there. My closing time chatter is the horror of Bongo's Bingo Night in Liverpool, where they've combined bingo and dance music.
Is it full song?
Bongo Masters Breakout. It looks like a living hell. Okay, I am a metropolitan metrosexual media ponce, but God, it looks terrible. The latest iteration of school disco or breakfast raves or yoga raves. My brother is in Liverpool and he says it's terrible. He says it's just an absolute whopper magnet. Personally, I blame Hacienda Classical for combining things with dance music that shouldn't be combined with dance music. Bongo's Bingo Night. Dance music and bingo. So they could shout house?
Probably.
If they fill the thing, do they shout techno or, you know, drum and bass?
Intelligent drum and bass.
Absolutely. God.
Two fat chemical brothers.
Absolutely, yeah. Kelly's eye. Huge big pill. Anyway, that's the end of the show. Thanks to Eamon Ford and Will Hodgkinson for joining us. You're going to be sticking around for the extra bit, I hope, to talk about the best and worst people that you've interviewed.
I think we're legally blind.
Don't worry, we'll be long. Patreon backers, look out for that extra bit arriving soon, where we'll be talking to our guests a little bit further. Thanks to Sean and producer Alex Rees. Thanks to you for listening, and we'll see you all next time. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye.